White nose syndrome has killed more than 5.7 million bats in the United States since it was discovered in New York State in 2006. And Iowa's bats are also at risk. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. We'll talk about the bats of Iowa and the important role they play in our ecosystem. We'll also talk about human-bat interactions, why you sometimes find them in your house, and what you should do if that happens. Also, we'll talk about white nose syndrome, a frightening fungal disease that is putting the future of these beneficial creatures at risk. Jim will also answer your questions. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. August and September are the months that you are most likely to find a bat in your home, an experience that is always stressful for human and bat and sometimes frightening. This hour, we're going to learn about the bats of Iowa. We'll find out what we should do if we come into contact with them, and we'll also talk about the future of these creatures. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
Do the whole hour that way, please.
All right.
Well, you know, I think that bats have gotten a lot more attention in the past few years, but there are still all of these prejudices against these creatures and all of these preconceived notions that people have that come from movies, just like the one you just referenced.
That's right. Well, you know, they go back before movies, though, because the whole issue, the whole thing about Transylvania and everything, that has been present in European mythology for centuries, you know. So it's really... It goes back in human, far into human existence, I think, that there are certain critters, if they're not very much like us, that we have all these myths about. And we, you know, we make up these incredible stories to try and justify those myths. And bats have suffered for that for centuries and centuries, probably millennia. So even before movies. But certainly the movies have reinforced it. We haven't yet had... We've had snakes on planes. I'm not sure we've had bats on planes yet, have we, or anything like
not
that?
Not quite
but,
yet.
Yeah,
I'm
but
sure
it's
coming.
There are a lot. Yeah, now that I've mentioned it, you know, somebody will come up with it. But there certainly are a lot of prejudices against them, and really, they're one of our, just like so many of our critters that are misunderstood. They're really one of our most important ecologically in our environment, and one of our most important, even from a human standpoint, they actually help in so many ways, not only in terms of pollinating crops, primarily in the tropics, but also in terms of taking care of insects that are very destructive of our crops, and that's true right here in Iowa.
How many different species of bats are there in the world? Do you know?
I think we're close to 850, somewhere between 850 and 900, right around in there.
It's, okay, so they come in a lot of different sizes and colors and habits.
Well, the one of the species we have in Iowa, the eastern pipistrelle, is almost, you know, sort of a large bumblebee size. The body is. The wings are a little bigger than that, of course. But so they go from that all the way up to these very large fruit bats, the flying foxes of Southeast Asia, the fruit bats of Australia and the Philippines, and some in South and Central America as well. You know, and so those are big, large mammals, but you know, you're talking a fruit bat that might be the body a foot long and the wingspan that can span up to 3.5 to 4 feet. This is a very large critter. So.
Now, of course, all the bats in Iowa are significantly smaller than that.
Yes.
How many different species do we have in Iowa?
We have 9 in Iowa. 9 common or relatively common. A couple of pretty rare ones, but we do have a total of 9 species in the state, and all of them in Iowa. In fact, all of the bats in the United States are insect eaters. We don't have fruit bats here. We don't have the ones that are thought to be live on blood, or those that we don't have those that live on frogs. These are all insect eaters in the United States.
And of course, you do mention the ones that eat blood. We should probably give the vampire bats a little bit of attention,
right,
because,
right,
of course, they are the ones that people think of, often first when they think about bats. And they do drink blood. They don't drink human blood usually.
Right, right. Exactly. And that's, I don't know how that got into the mythology, but I'm certain there are somebody who's tracked that down. But the vampires, there are three species in Central and South America, and they live off of mammalian, usually mammalian blood, but not piercing the veins and sucking it all in like you see in the movies, but rather by piercing just the skin and licking it off of the surface of the backs of large mammals, usually cattle and things like that. Particularly, and I've been in Central and South America for many, many years now, and I have yet to see a vampire bat down there and identify it as such. So it's
and you've probably been looking.
Yes, I have. Love to see one. It'd be great. So all the species we have in the U.S. are insect eaters. And as I mentioned a minute ago, most of them are feeding on insects that are very destructive of crops or feed on us. And so it's good to have them around.
So let's talk about some of the common bats in Iowa. You mentioned that we have 9 different species, mm-hmm. but really those, not all of them are ones that are seen very often.
Right, right. Well, most people, because most people don't see them up close and personal. They think all bats are sort of the same size, and they all look like big brown bats or little brown bats. And really, they're very if you look at them individually, the species are very distinctive. You can tell them apart relatively easily. But in flight, when they're just flying overhead, it's very difficult to tell them apart.
All right. And the big brown bat, which you just mentioned, is the one that a lot of people think that they see. And a lot of people do see big
right.
brown bats, if
right.
they do see bats at
yeah.
all. But big is kind of a misnomer.
Right. Right.
How yeah. big are they?
You're not talking of a species that is, terribly large in size. You're talking the body from the tip of the nose to the tail is only about 3.5 inches long, and you've got a wingspan of about maybe 10 to 12 inches at the most. So that's if you really stretch them out, the full length. So you're not really talking a big critter. But the pipistrelle, on the other hand, as I said, is the body is really only sort of a large bumblebee size critter, and it still has a wingspan of 5 to 5.5 inches. So, when it's flying around overhead, you're thinking, gee, this is, they all kind of look the same. So they really are quite different in size. So the one that most people probably see is the big brown or the little brown, because those are the two most common, particularly the two that are most common around cities and towns and in houses. They females will use summer roosts inside buildings if they are made available. And, of course, around cities and towns, you say, well, why are they there? Think about all the lights and all the insects that are attracted to the lights. And many species of our bats are common, even the solitary bats, things like the silver-haired bat or the red bats or hoary bats. Those are solitary. They're not colonial species. And they will be attracted to cities as well because of the insects that are around gather around the lights of cities.
Well, and big brown bats and little brown bats also live in colonies. And so does that make them more likely to be seen as well because there are greater numbers in a concentrated area?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And there appear to be greater numbers of big browns and little browns overall. Solitary bats are a little harder for us to track, and so I think that they're not as well known, and they're probably not as populous as some of the colonial nesting species like little browns and big browns. Now, let me explain colonial nesting because it might be misleading to people to as they think about colonies, because these are really colonies that are segregated by sex. In the summertime, the roosts that might be in your attic, for example, or in my attic, would be primarily colonies of females and young. So these are nursery colonies. Males will occur in groups, usually smaller groups, and they are not found with the females in the summertime. In fact, this time of year, in August, is the only time, August and September, is when we find males and females mixing really readily. And, of course, over the winter, sometimes in caves where they're hibernating. But during the summer, the spring and summer, they're in separate sexed groups. So a colony consists in your attic of females and their young. They're one to two young.
Now, they commonly also will have colonies in barn rafters and spaces like that, and of course bat houses as well. Would it be common for there to be a colony or a group of males and a group of females and young in the same building, or are they normally farther apart?
They're normally farther apart. I suppose if you've got a really big cave or a really big barn, you might have males roosting in one end and the female colony in the other. The females are usually fairly close together, and there's a very good reason for that, because the females, the mothers, still have to go out and feed each night, even after they have their young. Their young are born hairless and blind at birth. And so as the females go out and feed, they'll cluster all the young together in one cluster in order to keep them warm while they go out and feed. So it's a survival thing for them. Interestingly, whether you have a dozen or several hundred female bats, they're able to come back and find their own young in order to nurse them, which is really remarkable when you think about it.
They all look the same to us.
Yeah, they do. But they sound different and they look different to them. So they're able to identify their own young coming back to these clusters of hundreds of little young ones.
Are there always adults with the babies, or are the babies left on their own?
Well, the babies are pretty much left on their own, although not all females will go out at the same time to feed. So oftentimes there'll be, a few females left around. But, we don't know why that is. Maybe it's just spontaneous babysitting. Maybe it's not.
So we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about the bats of Iowa this hour with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the bats of Iowa. We're talking about them now because this is a time of year when many humans do come into contact with bats. We'll talk about how to handle that situation in a few minutes. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. And Jim, we were talking about how the big brown bats and the little brown bats will have nursing colonies or colonial
right,
childcare,
right.
But which is amazing to me. But I also am just astonished by how these solitary bats raise their young. Can you tell us a little bit more about some of the solitary species, like the hoary bat?
Yeah, the hoary bat, the red bat, the silverhead, those are all solitary species. And we will not find those in human dwellings at all, not found in buildings. In fact, the only ones that are found in buildings in Iowa, at least, are the big brown and the little brown. The solitary bats are like all of our bats. They appear to breed. The breeding time varies a little bit, but they appear all to breed in this time of the year, so from August to from now until they go to their hibernacula, so the in the late summer, early fall. And the sperm are apparently held inside the female until later in the winter when they come out of hibernation, and then they are fertilized at that point and have a couple of months gestation. The solitary bats then will have their young, and they may have, depending on the species, most species have one to two, but some of these species have up to three or four. And they're found up in the leaves of trees. So they take shelter underneath the leaves, particularly larger-leaved trees, everything from sycamores and oaks to, you know, other things that are found with fairly large leaves that, can shelter them. And the female raises the young all by herself with no help from the males at all. And they're pretty remarkable. Again, they're mammals, so they're feeding their, young milk, and the female has to drop off the branch in the evening, go out and feed, comes back and nurses them again. So it's a pretty remarkable thing that she's doing totally on her own.
And does she always leave the babies behind?
For the first couple of months, yeah, or the first month or so, it depends on the species. They have different rates at which the young ones can develop into flight. There have been reports of some of them actually carrying a single young as they fly, but I'm not sure how common that is.
It seems like it would be very, very difficult.
Very difficult,
but
right.
those young seem like they would be so much more at risk than the bats that are in a colony. It seems like they could get cold so much easier.
Oh, that's true, but that's why you choose trees that have, you know, large draping leaves in order to hold them in. But you're right, they are more at risk, so they're for getting cold in particular. But they'll choose, you know, a lot of these bats are incredibly they know how to thermoregulate pretty readily. For example, many bats will use the if we're not talking about buildings, where else would they potentially roost? Well, in hollow trees, underneath the bark of trees. And we've found that bats will spend the day underneath the loose bark of trees, things like shagbark hickories or elms that are dying with their bark falling off, a few other species, but especially shagbarks and that have very loose bark. And they will, on a warm day, a very hot day, they'll be on the north side of the tree where it's cooler. On a cool day, like this morning, when it was, you know, fairly cool, they would be found on the southeastern side or the south side of the tree in order to stay warm. So that loose bark allows them to kind of move around on the same tree without and maintain the right temperature. And they'll certainly do the same with their young. So while some species will use leaves, like the red bats, they'll often get up underneath the bark of some colonies, or some individuals will have their young underneath the loose bark as well. So again, they can maintain, sort of thermoregulate the temperature for those young ones.
Now, let's talk about wintertime, because, of course, that's something that a lot of us think about with bats, is
right.
their hibernation.
Yeah.
And tell me a little bit about, let's start again with the colonial species, big brown bat and little brown bat. What kind of spaces are they looking for, and how long do they spend in the winter in isolation?
Yeah, well, they have to, it depends where they are in the environment. If they're living down south in Georgia or Florida, they may not spend nearly as long in hibernation, obviously, as they do in Iowa or Wisconsin or Minnesota. And we do have bats that hibernate in caves here in Iowa, as well as farther north. I've seen bats as far north, hibernating in caves as far north as central Minnesota. And so bats don't necessarily migrate to the south. They in the fall of the year, they may migrate east, they may migrate west, they may even migrate north as well as south. Depends where the hibernacula are. And these hibernacula have to have the right not only temperature but humidity as well. Natural caves are particularly good because they often have a flow of air out from the interior, so it maintains that warmth, and they need to be right around 30, 32 degrees. So they drop much below that, and they cannot maintain their temperature over the winter because these are hibernators. Their body, all the metabolism slows way down. Their heart rate and respiration rate slows way down. And they are in a state of sort of suspended animation, living off their fat reserves for as much as, 3 to some years, 6 months. So we're really, it depends where they are, of course, and sometimes longer. So in order to live off those fat reserves for that long, you have to have a very low metabolism, and you have to not be disturbed much through the winter. And that's become a critical thing with white nose syndrome and other things. But we'll talk about that in a little bit. But so they have to get through that winter just living off those fat reserves. So that means this time of year and right before they hibernate, they have to really build up those fat reserves tremendously. And it's why at this time of the year is the most common time to see them, because first of all, there are more bats around because the young are out flying with their mothers. And secondly, they are trying to build up those fat reserves, and there are lots of insects available right now. Usually the end of the summer is the height of the insect season too. So they're feeding very heavily on those insects. And thirdly, it's the breeding season. So you've got three reasons why they're so common this time of year. So that they build up those fat reserves in order to maintain life through the winter.
How many insects can a big brown bat eat in an evening?
Well, there have been lots of reports, and I have to say they probably don't eat as many mosquitoes as we'd like them to, because mosquitoes are usually very close to the ground, and bats usually fly a little higher up than that. All the bats in Iowa are primarily woodland species, and so you'll see them flying anywhere from usually 6 to 40 or 50 feet off the ground, eating insects in that range. And most of the mosquitoes are down a little lower than that. So they'll take some. But there have been reports. Merwin Tuttle, who's one of the foremost bat researchers and advocates for bats in the world, runs Bat Conservation International, or founded it. He had a paper out in the 80s, I think, and he said up to 600 small insects in an hour, a single hour. So whether they would, double that in a night, because they'll feed pretty heavily for at least a couple of hours, but who knows? But it certainly depends on the size of the insect that they're taking, but they will consume a lot of insects in a long period of time. Now, how they do that was, of course, interesting, very interesting to me, because they're using echolocation, a type of a sonar that they are very well developed for, unlike any other mammal. They put out signals in the ultrasonic range. It's not the ones that we can hear at all, so because it's ultrasonic, 180 or so megahertz, and we only hear to about, hear well in the 20 to 40 hertz range, or megahertz range. So we're really talking ultrasonic. They put those out, it bounces off the insect, comes back, and they have a special part of their brain that actually interprets what it is they're bouncing off of, how far away it is, exactly whether it's prey or whether they should avoid it. As they get closer and closer, they'll actually put out the sonar faster and faster. So you can, you have a bat detector that can convert that ultrasound to sounds that we can hear. You'll hear them going beep, 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 as they get closer and closer to the insect. It's pretty amazing.
in the wintertime, how do the more solitary bats get through?
Well, they'll do the same thing. They hibernate, and often in the same caves as colonial bats. So you don't have to be basically hibernacula. Just as with snakes often, you'll have a number of species in the same hibernaculum. And the same is true with bats as well. And it's one of the reasons we're very, very concerned with white nose syndrome, is because you can, hibernacula may be collections of bats from over a very large area. And if a disease gets into a cave, it can impact not only many populations at one time from a very broad area, but many species at the same time. And that's a real concern.
Now, we've mentioned a couple of times that this is a time of year that a lot of people come into contact with bats. Why would a bat come into your house, into your living area? It doesn't seem like a place that a bat would like to be.
Yeah, well, think about young drivers, I guess, is the way to think of it. Lots of times our new drivers, young drivers, will end up in places they're not supposed to be, and it's because of lack of experience. So most often, we're having younger bats by mistake that enter into the house. That's not always the case, but it's most often young ones because they're just inexperienced at flying. Bats follow air currents. That's how they find their way in and out of your attic, because if your attic is very warm and the outside is very cool, there's autumn and there's a crack between the two. There's automatically airflow. Excuse me, from the between the warm and cool area, and they simply follow those air currents. When you open your door to the house, there's an air current because of the temperature differential between inside and outside. There's an air current, and often they'll just follow those air currents right in. If you prop your door open, you're going to have this tremendous airflow and probably end up with bats and insects and all kinds of things in your house. So they're simply following the air currents, and young bats in particular are prone to end up where they shouldn't be. The other thing is that this time of year, you do have these tremendous differences between inside and outside, up and down chimneys, in and out of attics. And so the airflows are particularly marked at this time of year. And so we're much more likely to end up with them in the house.
Okay. So if you see one in your house, what's the first thing you should do?
Panic. I'm teasing. Basically, it's recognize that they're there by mistake. They don't want to be there any more than you want them there necessarily. And the best thing to do is to simply open the door or open the window and take the screen out. Again, they follow those air currents, and chances are very good that they will simply fly right on out.
And you want to turn off the lights?
You can. Not necessary one way or the other. They're not blinded by the lights any more than we are necessarily. And you may want to watch where they are. You can actually sort of kind of steer them towards the door with a broom or something that will help you push them a little bit towards the front door. But basically, open that door. The door is better than a window because usually it's up a little higher. And it opens up a little higher, so that they'll find that breeze a little better. But simply steering them towards that. Now, if they are roosting already, you find them behind a curtain or something like that. If you take a coffee can and place it very carefully over them, and then slide a piece of cardboard underneath, you can remove them in the coffee can and simply take them outside, where they can do the job that they're set up to do, and that's catching insects. So they're not interested in us at all.
Now, of course, a lot of people are frightened of rabies, and we had a comment on our Facebook page saying it's
sure.
too bad that bats are one of the three main carriers of rabies in Iowa.
Yeah.
How great is that risk?
It turns out that it's not a great risk at all. And in fact, the the writer has used a term that is commonly used, the carriers of rabies. And that is actually not the case. Rabies is a very deadly disease, and it's deadly to bats. We used to think that they were, that they could carry it without showing any symptoms, without dying, and it's not true. Bats that get rabies will die. That's all there is to it. And now it turns out that they can shed, some species can shed live rabies virus for a few days before they show symptoms themselves. So in that sense, they can be, they can carry it for a few days without showing the active symptoms. But they never are, they're the furious rabies that is common sometimes in dogs and raccoons, and that is not found in bats. It's a different variety entirely. Now, rabies is rabies, and it is always a very, it's a deadly disease. It's a killer disease. With very few exceptions, humans who contract rabies don't survive. Same is true, though, of bats as well. They will not survive rabies. So they're not carriers in that sense. Also, it turns out that the ones that are tested at our state hygienic lab are, you know, bats that have sort of it's a subpopulation of bats overall that is a biased sample because there are bats that have been seen in the daytime. They may be lying on the ground outside your door or something. So these are bats that are already a subpopulation. So they're sick bats, and it turns out of those tested, depends on the year, but a lot of times it's anywhere from 4 to as much as 20% of those tested. Overall, it's less than half of 1% nationally.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back and talk more about bats in just a moment with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. Jim is an environmental, interpretive, and wildlife consultant based in Ames, and you're welcome to join the conversation at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about bats in Iowa with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. And just before the break, we were talking a little bit about rabies. One of the common misconceptions about bats is that many bats are carriers of rabies and put all of us at risk if we come into contact with them. That said, you, as you just said, less than one half of 1% of the bat population in Iowa
right,
could have rabies at any
right,
given time, and it is a deadly disease for them, so they're not carriers.
Right.
But if you get bitten by a bat, what should you do?
Well, the chances of that are extremely slim because most of their canine teeth are not long enough to even puncture human skin. But, you know, it's certainly, it's possible, so you shouldn't be handling them in the first place, you know. So that's the one thing. But what happens, of course, is that people will often see them in their house, and they'll let them out. And particularly if if it's happened during the night, they say, "Well, I was awakened. I don't know if I got bit or not." And of course, medical personnel will. Always err, particularly with a deadly disease, on the cautious side. So they will automatically say you need to get the shots that will help to keep you from getting rabies. Even though the bat has never been tested, maybe the bat was let go or not killed or not, you know, whatever, they err on the cautious side. And I don't blame them for that, but I think it's most often is an overreaction. But again, it's a deadly disease, so who wants to take the chance?
Right.
So if you have been bitten, certainly, and you know you've been bitten, then see your doctor immediately and begin the series of shots that you can get. They're much less painful than they used to be. When I was growing up, it was, I think, a dozen shots, and they were in the belly. And, boy, they were pretty nasty. I know my sister had to get some, not from bats, but from other critters she was around. So it was pretty nasty. But now it's basically three shots, and it's a series in the arm over a period of several weeks. So it's it's not cheap, but it certainly is a preventative. Now, again, so if you know you've been bitten, absolutely go and see your doctor. If you just have seen bats around, don't overreact. But again, if you think there's a chance that you've been bitten, then see your doctor. And chances are very good that they will err on the cautious side and have you get the shots.
And bats are a protected species in Iowa, right?
Well, bats, all species are protected outside of human dwellings. In human dwellings, the only one that's protected is the Indiana bat, and the chances of Indiana bats being in a dwelling are slim and none, basically.
The chance of seeing an Indiana bat is
pretty slim, yeah, exactly, although they are seen occasionally, but only if you're If you're out there trying to net them in the evening is about the only time you really see
and
them.
And that is a species that's on the federal endangered species
right,
list.
Right, exactly. So the Indiana bat or the Indiana myotis is a totally federally protected. But if they're in your house, you're allowed certainly to protect your dwelling. And so they are not protected. But like all wildlife, they're protected in the wild. So, yeah.
And there are usually ways to remove a bat without injuring either human or bat.
Right, yeah, and exactly. If you have a colony in your house, and I can understand why folks don't want to necessarily share their homes with them, they can, while the feces are dry, when you have a large colony, the smell can percolate down into the rest of the house. So how do you deal with a colony of bats in your living area? Well, first of all, you want to make sure that if they're in your attic, for example, or your basement, that they don't have any access to the living area of the house. And what that means is, remember that I said that they follow air currents. So they found their way into your house by following air currents, and they will find their way, if they have to, they will find their way down into the living area by following those same air currents. In the case of bats in a basement, it might be that they'll come underneath the door that comes up from the basement. So you simply block off that door with a towel or a bunch of rags or something like that. You stop the air current, therefore you stop them coming. I've had friends who had them in the attic, and they opened up the wall for some reason, and it was open for a long period of time, and sure enough, they had bats coming into the house. Well, they were coming down from the attic, following those air currents right in there. So what you have to do, in first thing to do then is exclude them from the living area. Then if you want to exclude them totally from the house, you need to figure out where they're coming in. And you can do that simply by watching in the evening, right about dusk. Look up around the eaves of your house, behind the fascia board, often under the eaves. There are cracks that develop, particularly in older homes. There are cracks that develop. And all it takes is a crack, maybe 3/8 of an inch in size. It's pretty small, less than half an inch, and maybe a 3 or 4 inches long. That's not a very big crack, and it's often hard to see from the ground. So you need to watch where the bats come out. Once you identify that place, don't just block it up because you're going to trap bats in there. But this is a time of year that young are going out with their mothers on evening flights, so it's a good time of year to be doing the exclusion. And the way you do it is you then, during the daytime, you create what's called a one-way door. You put a piece of either half-inch netting, like we put over fruit trees to protect them from birds, or screen wire. You put it over so it overlaps by, a foot or so on every side, the opening that they're coming in and out of. You put tape, duct tape, another use for duct tape, tape it down the two sides and the top, allowing them to, so you use screen wire or netting because the air current is still allowed to get through that then. So then they can still feel that air current. They'll come out. They'll go work their way down the screen and go out the bottom where you've left it open. And so you leave it just loose enough where they can kind of squeeze through. And when they come back, they'll come to where the opening is, but now it's screened off, so they can't get back in. So the screen is over it. So it's a one-way door. They can get out. You leave that up for several days to make sure that they've all gotten out. And then you can seal that up with foam, that expanding foam insulation stuff, or tape, or caulking, or something like that. They're not going to chew their way back in. But you only want to do that like in August, late August, early September, or in early May before the females have their young. So you only do the exclusion in those two times of year. Otherwise, you're trapping bats in there, and being trapped inside not only is a horrible way to die, but it increases your chances of them coming down into the house trying to get out.
Right. So. Let's go to the phones. Joe is on the line in Madrid. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Charity.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, I would like to know if there's any research or anything discouraging people from building bat houses or man-made structures for bats. This is Joe from the Iowa Arboretum Charity, and your tree's doing well.
Oh,
out here.
Good to hear it, Joe.
Just to let you know that. But yeah, I thought about putting a class on here about building bat boxes, and I'd come over or come by a little research online that's discouraging that, because then the bats don't get used to their natural habitat.
Well, I don't know of I haven't seen that research, Joe. I'd be interested, if you want to send that to me, I'd be interested to see the quality of the research. I would doubt it, because human buildings for the species that are most likely to use bat houses, and that's big browns and little browns in Iowa, hasn't prevented them from using hollow trees or caves when they're available or things like that. So I highly doubt that, but I'd be interested in seeing the research. Bat houses, however, are not necessarily, if you look at the research nationally, it's not like putting up a rent house where you're going to get occupancy like almost immediately. You
yeah.
know, they're not as successful. And it may in part be that that people are putting them up in poor locations, or just not putting them up high enough, or whatever. But nationally, it looks like you only get at best 50 to 60% occupancy of bat houses. And that's after 2 to 3 or 4 years of having them up. They apparently use their sense of smell to a very strong site tenacity. They come back year after year to that same site, and particularly the colonial nesting species. So it may be that they're using some sort of memory of that site, but also they use their sense of smell. So some people say if you put some fresh bat guano in your bat house, there's a greater chance that it'll be occupied. Again, the stuff I've seen is pretty mixed on that. So they're not a be-all and end-all, but I guess I would doubt that. I'd like to see the quality of the research that was done. So if you can send that to me, that'd be great. So.
All right, Joe, thanks a lot for your call. And I do want to spend a little time talking about white nose syndrome, which showed up in a cave in New York State in 2006. Since that time,
yeah.
It has killed maybe almost as many as 6 million bats
yeah.
in the
yeah.
United States. It has shown up in Iowa, although it hasn't been widespread mm-hmm. in the state yet. What is white nose syndrome, as far as we know?
Yeah, white nose syndrome is caused, research is pretty solid now, caused by a fungus. The fungus has been named Pseudogymnoascus destructans. So it's been put in a different genus than it was originally, and it turns out it's in the same genus as a lot of fungi that are present in bat caves, and have been found and associated with bats that are not harmful at all. In fact, this fungus has been found in the UK in Great Britain, and across Europe, very commonly associated in the soils and in bat caves over there. And it turns out those bats are resistant to it. It doesn't appear to – it's not associated with great numbers of dead bats. It's not associated with white nose syndrome over there. So it arrived in the U.S. apparently sometime prior to 2006, and bats here are not immune to it, and it's been causing this fungal growth during the hibernaculum or hibernation period. The fungal growth that seems to be most destructive is around the nose and eyes, and so it's thus its name, white nose syndrome. And the fungus growth essentially causes them, as I mentioned earlier, causes them to wake up a lot during the winter. It uses appears to use their reserves up, because waking up is a very expensive, energetically expensive thing. They have to get their body going again. So if they wake up and then they go back into hibernation, they have fewer fat reserves, and usually they don't survive the winter. And while it appears so far that it doesn't necessarily kill them directly, it's this process of waking them up a lot, at the very least, that that doesn't allow them to survive through hibernation.
And this is a very, very frightening problem.
Oh,
this
yeah.
could mean the end of a number of different bat species, could
oh,
it not?
Yeah. Particularly if you've got things like Indiana bats that are already federally endangered, and if they're contracting this through the wintertime, there are very few places that they overwinter. And if it gets into those caves and kills them, we could wipe out whole species without any problem. We can also wipe out the ones that so far have been terribly effective are actually big brown bats and little browns. So they're really, it's a serious, serious worry within the wildlife community and within the scientific community, and ought to be for all of us, because it means here's a primary insect predator that could be in real trouble. So it's a what's interesting, though, of course, the latest research I saw. Oh, there are a couple of things. One is that it was just announced, I think, last Friday, that it has been found in Minnesota. So it's now been found in 23 states. And 5 provinces in Canada. So it's really very widespread here. But because it's been identified now as the same genus as a number of other fungi, they're hoping to be able to figure out what is it about this particular destructans that is so fatal, whereas the other fungi that are very closely related don't seem to impact them at all. So they're working on that angle. Right now, and there's a lot of research going on. There's research going on here in Iowa, just trying to get a baseline of what bats we have and what are the numbers are, particularly in the hibernacula, and to what degree it's impacting them. So it's a very scary disease for those folks who are especially interested in bats. But as I say, I think we all ought to be very concerned about it.
How would it change our world here in Iowa if we didn't have bats?
Well, bats are, as I say, a primary insect predator, particularly on many agriculturally destructive insects. So bats are a very important predator on those insects, and it may mean a change. It potentially could mean a change in our agricultural system, or things that we have to do to adapt to the lack of that predator. It's kind of one of those things, Charity, that we often don't understand something how important it was to us until it's gone. And I hope we don't get to that point with bats, because they're a very important part of our ecological balance, if you will, or our ecological system. And those misunderstandings that we talked about earlier are gradually, through research, being unraveled and the myths being destroyed. And we're finding out, gee, these are really an important part, not only in tropical systems, but in temperate systems like we have across the United States and Canada.
Jim,
as well.
So, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is an environmental interpretive and wildlife consultant based in Ames. And with me now is Ben Kiefer, host of River to River. What's coming up at noon today, Ben?
Hi, Charity. Coming up in the first half hour, we'll talk with Kyle Munson, a columnist for the Des Moines Register, about the butter cow vandalism at the Iowa State Fair. Also, some other things going on at the Iowa State Fair. Other guests as well. We'll talk about how this cool weather is affecting the crops and the crop markets. Also, Iowa's first digitized cemetery. We'll hear what that
figure
does
out
for
what
our,
that is.
Yes, we will. Thank you, Charity.
All right, thanks a lot. That's River to River at noon. This is Talk of Iowa.